in Academic Street. When he was on Academic Street, when he was inspired. One of my favorite pieces. I'm going to play it with the Boston Symphony this year.
You are.
I was just going to say, Modestement.
Yep.
They never do it here.
Yeah,
it's a masterpiece.
I'll be looking for it.
And the Concert Musique for Brass and Strings is was written for the Boston Symphony, the 50th anniversary, right? And therefore, to celebrate the 100th anniversary, I'm doing a concert in Boston of all such pieces.
When?
Let's see, I'm doing the concert. It's in December, I think. The end of their 100th year. Finally, they've been celebrating their 100th anniversary for ages. And I wrote the divertimento for them. It's not so little. It's 16 minutes long. What do you want for my life? It's lighthearted.
Yeah, that's right.
It has a samba and a turkey trot and a waltz.
And this is 7-8.
No, I'm just glad to hear it because I hear
did you like the way
old
did it?
He's the old hat.
Seiji conducted very well. But
what kind of person did you work with? He seems like such a person who has such a
He was a heavenly man. He was such fun and jolly. But he's very unfashionable at the moment. And I'll tell you, a good parallel is Thomas Mann, who is a rather similar person, who has been unfashionable for decades now. I mean, when I went to Harvard, one read The Magic Mountain, automatically. The courses that were given in the 20th century novel were Proust, Joyce, and Mann.
Yeah.
Automatically, it's just Proust, Joyce, Mann,
there's
right?
Still a course in life back there.
Then it was Proust, Joyce, and Nabokov, or whatever. And Mann just faded out of the curriculum because the academy, as the faculty, decided it was unfashionable. And when I was doing the Norton lectures at Harvard in 73, 4, whatever it was, I couldn't believe it. No one that I came across had ever read The Magic Mountain, this extraordinary masterpiece. Say nothing of the novellas, say nothing of the short stories like Tristan, like Tonio Krüger, Mario and the Magician, The Transposed Heads, that last short novel he wrote called The Black Swan. Nobody knows it. This last piece, the Joseph books, four great novels on Joseph and his brothers. Say nothing of Dr. Faustus, which is one of the most extraordinary novels ever written. And The Magic Mountain, which is it. I mean, The Magic Mountain is it the way Ulysses is it.
Look into it, yeah. We have a
you look into it. You don't, nobody's read The Magic Mountain.
No, we'll have a course. There is a course where they read Ulysses, Mann, and...
Mann is back.
Yeah, it's on.
You know why he's back? Yeah. I made a scene at Harvard.
Did you? Well,
with Harry Levin and Teddy Morris, all the people who are giving the whole English department, the whole literature department, I screamed. And the next year, Mann was back. And all of you know what also helped? It wasn't just me. I mean, naturally, I'm just boasting.
Well, no.
No, it wasn't. It was Luchino Visconti's picture of Death in Venice, which I loved Luchino, but you know, I don't even think it's the right film version of that novella. But everybody suddenly began to read Death in Venice because of the movie.
Mm.
And that helped to get people acquainted with Mann again. And something like that has to happen with Hindemith to get him back on the...
We're going
to
bring him back.
One thing I did, yeah, you could help a lot. When I was doing the young people shows, of which I did about, I did 52 in all while I was here. That's a lot of scripts to write. And I took them very seriously. I wrote four or five drafts of every script, down to the last comma on the teleprompter. Everything had to be exactly right, and it had to come in at 49 minutes and 33 seconds because there were commercials and stuff. And it was very hard to time it and get everything said. But I began to do more and more difficult programs for the young people, and the more difficult they were, the huger was the fan mail. I mean, it was extraordinary because I didn't talk down to those kids.
And see what they're doing now.
What I did one on Zarathustra or Strauss, not just the opening bars, which everybody knows in a kind of Kubrick's picture, or because of there's a disco arrangement. Well, there is. I mean, bam, 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 wadoo. Anyway, I went into the philosophy of it, and I went into Zarathustra, Nietzsche, the works, and I told what the piece was really about in terms of mortality and immortality, and so on. I've never had such a response from kids, 13-year-old kids, plumbers, old people, young people, parents of these kids. And I did a show on the moods, explaining the...
Great.
You've never seen that?
No, yeah, no, I didn't
you're
see it.
You're too
that
young,
show.
You see. You're,
no, but it's I mean, only I know people... About the moods, and they're like, oh,
older
no
people
one.
Now remember those shows.
Oh,
like yesterday,
no,
but
well,
you saw a couple of the last ones.
No, they show them in all film.
Well, for example, in Hungary, you know, we were talking about Hungary before. They show one of these every week, forever. I mean, they do a series of 13, then they repeat the 13. Then they do another series of 13, and they repeat that.
Oh,
the Harvard lectures are always run. The BBC has run them four times. Four times.
We don't. We had them once repeated.
Because we have this goddamn commercial situation.
No,
PBS.
They'll do it again. They'll get around to it again. Anyway, but the video cassettes of that go to the universities.
Telephone was taken off when you had those lectures, and I didn't know if you bothered with anything.
Well, it's funny. After a concert a few years ago, I was visited backstage by Amalia Rodriguez, the great fado singer of Portugal.
Lisbon.
I never knew her, yeah. And she came in and she knelt. And I always remember that moment because it was very dramatic. And she's fabulous, the singer. Have you ever heard fado?
Oh, my gosh.
It's the Portuguese folk music, yeah. And she's the great exponent of it. Anyway, she came back and she said, you are the most popular single human being in Lisbon, where I've never been in my life.
You've never been there.
She said, you could walk down the main street of Lisbon, you'd be mobbed.
My goodness.
Because of your young people's concerts every Sunday. Mm-hmm. And when they happen to coincide with the bullfight, which is what people do on Sunday at 5, you know, a las cinco en punto de la tarde.
But in Portugal, they don't kill the bull.
They don't kill the bull. But they have the same excitement about the bullfight. The corrida coincides with a young people's concert. Nobody goes to the bullfight. That was her news. And the same thing is true in Hungary. The same thing is true in Bucharest, where, again, I've never been, but they write me and Sofia, Bulgaria. They say, if you walk down the street, you'll be mobbed.
Don't go to Sofia.
I'd love to go. The same thing is true in the Philippines, where I've never been.
Okay.
In darkest Norway, in I don't know where, they run these things all the time. And I am the hero of that country, whatever that is. It's extraordinary.
Well, Andre Watts remembers
Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm. Hmm? Andre Watts remembers very well.
He should. He made his debut there.
I saw that concert.
Yeah. Well, the reason I'm talking about this is Hindemith. We were talking about Hindemith. One of the programs I did was a program on Hindemith.
Oh.
Who is Paul Hindemith? It was subtitled like that.
Yeah.
Because nobody knew.
No one knew.
And I spoke with particular reference to the critics, and specifically to Harold Schoenberg, who is, you know, asshole of the first water. I didn't say that.
Cancel that.
Wipe it up. Oh, well, he is. I mean, why not say it? Everybody knows he is.
Yeah, right. Go ahead. But anyways, what did he
Anyway, I spoke about the fact that nobody played Hindemith anymore and nobody cared about him. And for these kids who never heard the word Hindemith in their lives, and I began to show them Hindemith. Old Hindemith from the 20s, Hindemith from the 30s. Concept was Music for Strings and Brass. I showed them what is in that piece.
That just grabbed me. I still does.
It's an unbelievable piece.
Every time I hear it.
I played them some Matisse. I played them. Oh, then I had Golden Fizdale come and play the Weber pieces on two pianos, or four hands, rather. And then I played the Hindemith version, and that ended the program. And it was wonderful fun. I got tremendous letters about that.
Can you promise me one thing when you're doing
that? I did one on Shostakovich. I did one on COVID. I did two on COVID. I did Schoenberg. I did everybody for the kids.
There's one, I think it's a G flat major chord in the end, towards the end of the second movement.
Are you in music?
Yes. I can't.
You're majoring in music. Anybody else here majoring in music?
Yeah. And you've got, there's this one section where the brass comes in, everything dies off.
That's why he's sort of the spokesman of this group.
You turn the score.
He's appointed himself sort of spokesman. Nobody else talks.
And there's the chord. Bang! It's got to go right. You've got to promise me they're going to do it
in
right.
In what piece?
In the concert music. The only time I've ever heard it was a broadcast on Chicago. It was done.
You know, I used it in another Young People's Concert. Which is called What Is a Melody? And I analyzed the elements of a melody and all the things a melody can be. Anything from a pop tune or a folk song, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star is a melody, to a Wagnerian line, which doesn't seem like a melody and yet is an endless melody. And I used this opening melody from the Concert Musique for Strings and Brass, which you can barely follow because the strings are all playing this extraordinary tune.
Yeah, that's what makes it so neat.
No, the brass is all playing it while the strings are playing the very active sound. Ram, ta-tum, 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 ba-ba-bum, ba-ba-bum. Yeah. And the brass is playing. And you don't recognize it as a melody. Until it is reprised in the slow movement.
Yeah, in the string, yeah.
And suddenly the strings play this. It's a great melody. It's exactly the same notes against brass chords. And then you just break up and you cry. And you realize that's what you had been hearing in the first movement. It's glorious. It's such a conception, a vision of music. So I used that in that show. And also I did that show in England for a particular television network called Granada, which originated in Manchester. I did it in Manchester for a full house of kids. And so all England knows that show.
Great.
And I use it, a lot. But you have to push it the way you have to push Thomas Mann.
We're pushing it. I push it all over the place. I can find
and the way you have to push certain painters like Miro, who become unfashionable suddenly.
Yeah.
They had a great moment, and then suddenly nobody cares.
People are, don't let Salvador Dali die, for example.
You never had to push Dali.
No, but he's on his, they're taking advantage of him.
Baby, he pushes himself.
Yeah,
enough. He doesn't need any help from us.
I have a question.
Shoot.
Why is it that there's so many really important works like Mozart 503 that really get neglected? I mean, that's fairly popular, but there are lots of great...
I'll tell you why. It's a very great concerto. But it's not usually played by pianists because it doesn't have a memorable opening tune or theme.
And the piano almost never plays the theme. It plays figure
work. But the opening theme isn't really a theme. It's just a succession of tonic chords and then dominant chords. And it's sort of pompous, and you say, what is this? What's it about? Where's the tune? But once you get to the tunes, the second and third themes, that Marseillaise tune, and then it becomes fantastic. And the rest of the concerto is extraordinary. But it is neglected for that reason, that it opens without one of those great Mozart tunes.
But it's very intellectual because of that.
Gotta go.
Gotta go.
I mean, it's really serious now. You've been hovering around for half an hour now. All right, one last question.
Can I try?
Yeah.
Well,
how do you approach, well, a piece of music like Brahms that you conducted probably dozens of times and that the orchestra has played dozens of times and is probably tired of? What do you try to put into it, usually? I mean, what do you want to get out of it? Yeah, ask.
Boy, is that a big one. I mean, that's an hour lecture, the answer to that one. Let's see if I can put it in 14 words. When a piece is a great piece, Brahms' second, let's say, Brahms' third, which I'm about to do in Vienna, Appalachian Spring, which has existed 40 years, and by now we know it will always exist, because there are certain pieces that you hear, and they may make an effect or a big impression, and they disappear. And there are certain pieces that grow with time. And then you know they're classics. If you go through 40 years, it's two generations more these days. Things are accelerated in that time. But a Brahms symphony was established, and with difficulty. You know, at the beginning it had the same problems. Critics said, well, it has no tunes, and it's academic and boring. Do you ever read those reviews of the Symphony Hall? I mean, those Boston reviews of the first time they heard Brahms symphonies, people walked out. Said, oh, this is too boring.
His own insecurities.
Said nothing of that. But anyway, the pieces are glorious. The four symphonies are, you know, you don't know which one you love the most. When a piece achieves that kind of status, you know that it is always new every time you do it. If it isn't, then don't do it. Just don't conduct it. But every time I do a piece like that, I restudy it from scratch, like a student. I remark everything, phrasings, and I look at it as though I've never seen it before, because I know it's going to furnish always new lights and insights. And if it doesn't, then I don't do it. If I don't find a new set of principles, then there's no point in doing it again. Then you're just doing routine. The minute you find that, a sensitive orchestra reacts to it. They find it too. And all of a sudden it becomes a festival to play this old Third Symphony of Brahms. I have this experience over and over. And when I don't have it, I don't play it. So that's your question. And it will go on forever that way. I mean, 100 years from now, if we survive Reagan and Al Haig and all that, which I rather doubt, I don't think, to say nothing of William French Smith. Oh, no, there's no way. I don't think we can survive it, unless a miracle happens. But if we do in 50 or 100 years, I do not sound like Gorby Dow.
Just on that little subject.
It's really very serious, the state we're in now. But we asked for it. I mean, we voted for it. We're stuck with it.
Some people did.
Most of us.
You have to say we.
So now he's our president.
You have to say we. And already the newspapers, yesterday's Times and today, you can see the beginning of the big disillusionment. Everybody's already finding out what an insanity they voted for. And it will be about a month, and every one of you will be so deceived and disillusioned, and you will see what the emptiness of that series of stupid promises.
The Times was never for Reagan, of course.
They had a big fight with themselves. I know about that. They came out very reluctantly for Carter. Anyway, let's not get into this, because that's a whole other discussion. All I'm saying is that if we survive this impossible mafia that has been assembled for a cabinet, ignorant crooks, everyone.
Erase that one.
The Secretary of Labor, who hates labor, the Secretary of the Interior, who hates the Interior, Secretary of State, who wants only to bomb everybody, nuke them. And the Assistant Secretary of State, who yesterday confessed he knew nothing, knew no Prime Minister in the world. He couldn't name the Prime Minister of South Africa. and he's the Assistant Secretary of State, and Mr. French Smith, who is the mafia lawyer for Sinatra, and everybody who has a Las Vegas problem, a gambling problem, a tax problem, he's their lawyer. He's the Las Vegas lawyer. Anyway, he's our national security advisor. We thought we had it bad with Brzezinski. Brzezinski's an Easter pageant compared to this. And he was a horror.
And so, anyway, can you make
the two come back to bronze if we survive? Yes, the same thing will be true in 100 years and 1,000 years. Because that kind of music, I mean, Beethoven, Fourth Symphony, whatever it is new. Every time you look at it, it's new. As Tristan was new for me, it's a brand new experience. And I played that score since I was 16 years old, all night at the piano, the next night, all night. Couldn't stop. Came in my jeans three times a week, the score. As a kid. A whole new piece. Because I studied the text very deeply, and I realized what a fantastic dramatist Wagner was in this one work. This is an einmalig piece. It's unique. It's not like any other Wagner opera or any other opera of anybody or any other musical work of anybody. It's quite isolated work on which the whole history of music can be seen to revolve around this pivot. Because after Tristan, music was never the same. Nobody's music was the same. Massenet was never the same. Nobody. Imagine sitting there in 1865 in Munich, which Massenet did, and Mallarmé, and everybody came, Schopenhauer, to go listen to this extraordinary, well, just a run-through. Wagner invited all these pals, and they were all shaken, and can you imagine what it is to listen to the first phrase of Tristan the first time?
I've never heard it myself.
Oh. Well, I would like to take you home now and play you that video cassette.
Well, they're doing it in the Met now.
Well, oh!
It is unbearable.
It's a much
But they just fooled the audience.